The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In his book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, economist Dr. Klaus Schwab, founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, argues that the scope of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is much wider than just smart and connected machines and systems. Instead, he argues, it is the fusion of technologies such as nanotechnologies, smart wearables, quantum computing, virtual reality, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and 5G, 6G, to name a few, and their interaction across the digital, biological, and physical worlds that sets this revolution apart from its predecessors. We are, he argues, in the throes of the fourth industrial revolution, where the confluence of these technologies will forever alter the way we live and work and even relate to one another. The metaverse is a perfect example of this confluence of the physical, digital, and biological universes in the fourth industrial revolution. Though metaverse became a buzzword after Facebook changed its company name to Meta in 2021, many people are still trying to understand what exactly the metaverse is, and frankly, whose vision of the metaverse will succeed, if any. Will it be a tightly controlled walled garden where any activity by your avatar leaves breadcrumbs of personal data eagerly harvested and monetized by whoever controls the walled garden? If so, what does that mean for interoperability? Or would it be decentralized, a sort of limitless Wild West where people can share ideas, cooperate, or start creating something fungible together? Will it have an economy? And if so, what is the currency? Right now, the metaverse is more of a concept than reality. However, if Dr. Schwab is right, the fourth industrial revolution and the metaverse as part of it will change our lives far more quickly and irrevocably than we can fathom. In addition to the promise of convenience and innovation, there's also the exponential pace that will very likely overwhelm our institutions and pose additional risks. The race is on. The competition to make, define, own, and monetize it has just begun.
Our guest today is Robert Tirsek. Robert is an award-winning author, content creator, entrepreneur, and educator focused on the process of dematerialization and innovation. He is the author of the best-selling book, Vaporized: Solid Strategies for Success in a Dematerialized World. As one of the world's most prolific creators of interactive content, he has created entertainment experiences on every digital platform, including satellite television, game consoles, broadband internet, interactive television, and mobile networks. Recognized for his contributions in social media for the benefit of society, he was named a Fellow of the Royal Society for the Arts in 2008. Residing at the intersection of entertainment, telecommunication, and computing, Robert helps organizations envision how to execute new technologies and create something that consumers will crave. With a background as both an entrepreneur and an artist, he has led the process of digital change in executive leadership roles at major media companies. Until 2010, he was president of digital media at OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. Previously, he served as the first senior vice president of digital media at Sony Pictures Entertainment, and earlier, he was creative director at MTV, Music Television. Today, he's the founder and CEO of General Creativity, a strategic advisory firm that provides insight and advice to corporations as they contend with digital transformation and the process of dematerialization into software. His client roster includes the who's who of the tech and entertainment world. Welcome, Robert.
Good morning. Hi, hello.
So we talked about how, although there is no metaverse now, the race is on to define what it will be and who will control it. So can you talk a bit about who are the players who are betting big on the metaverse and how similar or different are their visions?
Sure, sure thing. So it's early days, right? So the idea of the metaverse is not new itself. The idea has been around since the early 1990s. And most of us encountered it in science fiction, in particular Neal Stephenson's book, Snow Crash. So that's kind of like the origin story, I suppose, or the seed that was planted. And the funny irony there, of course, is when science fiction writers like Stevenson or like the book Ready Player One, when they talk about the metaverse, they're not talking about it as a good thing. They're talking about it as kind of like a warning of a dystopian future. And of course, our Silicon Valley heroes have taken that quite literally and decided to charge forward and go build the exact same thing that they were supposed to not build, everything the science fiction writers warned them not to build. What is it? It's an immersive world, more so than a game, more so than social media. You might think of it as a blending of social media, online commerce, anything you might do for work, like we're meeting on a Zoom call right now, but you might be able to do that in the metaverse as well. And so it's a place where you can meet, play, socialize, work, educate yourself, and do just about anything you would consider that you could do in the real world. At least that's what the brochure says. We're a long way from fulfilling that vision just yet. Now, the second part of your question is about companies. If you want, I can jump into that.
Sure.
Okay. So there's a lot of different companies that have kind of thrown their hat in the ring or declared an interest in the metaverse. Just a week ago, I was talking to a venture capital guy, analyst, and he said that they're now tracking 1,600 different metaverse projects. So that's not a small number. A lot of folks became aware of this term and this movement about 18 months ago when Mark Zuckerberg made a big announcement about Facebook's future. And he told the world, but principally investors, to start to think of Facebook not as a social networking company, but as a metaverse company. And shortly thereafter, just a couple months later, Facebook's name was changed to Meta to reflect that. So Meta Platforms, Inc., which now owns Instagram and Facebook and WhatsApp, and a new project that is called Horizons World. And Horizons World is Facebook's metaverse, if you will. It's a place where you can create an avatar. You can go in and communicate with people just as you would in social networking, but you can see them in 3D. And it's intended for virtual reality. So you're meant to be wearing an Oculus headset. And as you'll recall, Facebook bought Oculus for a couple billion dollars half a decade ago. And they've invested tens of billions of dollars since that time to really build it out. And honestly, you have to give Zuckerberg credit because he's getting nothing but flack for doing this. But the guy is pursuing this with single-minded devotion and incredible amounts of investment. And currently, the Oculus Quest 2 is the best VR headset. So if you've checked out VR in the past, maybe before the pandemic, and you were not impressed, well, in the last couple of years, VR has improved greatly. And frankly, Facebook or Meta gets the credit for doing that. So they're at the forefront. They're pushing this. But they're not the only company. There are quite a few other companies that are interested in the metaverse. And actually, long before Zuckerberg declared his intent to build out a metaverse, there were several companies starting up in the crypto space. So as you know, there's a big transition happening in the crypto world right now, away from currencies or, you know, away from projects that are solely focused on cryptocurrencies. You know, that was kind of the trend back in 2017. But many of those cryptocurrency ICO initial coin offerings that were made in 2017, a great many of them failed. The coins are inactive, the coins are worthless or next to worthless right now. Though there were a couple of projects that began in 2017 that really started to garner some interest and some support. And some of those are things like Decentraland. Decentraland is a decentralized metaverse, and it's not the only one. There are quite a few companies now that are developing immersive worlds, similar, I guess, in a way to Facebook Horizons. But they are built on the decentralized infrastructure that supports the blockchain, that supports cryptocurrency. And so that's kind of the core principle of what's emerging as Web3 right now. So, okay, so there's a kind of decentralized alternative. If you consider Facebook as like a super centralized company that controls a lot of data about you, they control all the revenue into that platform, they control all the apps that are built on top of that platform. So that's an example of like a Web 2.0 hyper-centralized company. There's a reaction against that among the decentralized firms that are arising. These are startups. But that's not all. It's really important to know that game companies are actually the best positioned companies to dominate the metaverse. And so among the game companies, we can't overlook Microsoft because they are becoming one of the biggest game companies in the world. They just bought Activision, or they're in the process of acquiring Activision. And of course, they own Minecraft. So Microsoft owns several game studios and publishers. And they're not the only big game company that's well positioned for the metaverse. There are a number of others. In the United States, certainly Epic, the company that makes Fortnite, is brilliantly positioned to be a leading player. And Epic is privately held. And just today, they made an announcement that they've raised a significant amount of money to go build their own version of the metaverse. And that strategic funding came from Sony and from the foundation that owns the Lego company. So Fortnite might turn into a metaverse. You might consider it almost like a proto metaverse because it is an immersive world where people congregate and do many things besides killing their friends on islands. And then their big rival, of course, is Roblox, which is a platform really for building games, for building 3D games, particularly focused at young people. Roblox is one of the most successful game companies in the United States. But that list goes on and on. And never forget that there are also gigantic game companies outside the U.S. We tend to think all the big game companies are based in the U.S. That's just not true. The biggest game company by far is Tencent. They're based in China, and they own a big portal in China. They own QQ, the big messaging service. They own a number of different things. They're one of the biggest music providers on the internet. They own stakes in many of the biggest game publishers, including Riot, the company that makes League of Legends. They own the Chinese version of PUBG, PlayerUnknown Battleground, which is a super popular game. So Tencent is the formidable company. They've already let it be known. Their chairman, Pony Ma, has already said, we have the resources to build our version of the metaverse as well. And then there are other companies as well. There are a couple of companies that have been focused on building out a kind of metaverse or immersive world for some time. Companies like Magic Leap, they've had their ups and downs. Magic Leap, before the pandemic, raised heroic amounts of money to build augmented reality. So that's a kind of a version of the metaverse that you could see around you projected on the real world as you walk outside in the street. They've had ups and downs, but they've reorganized and they're back in the game. And then another company a lot of people they tend to overlook is NVIDIA. And NVIDIA is a very important company because they make the graphical processing units, the chips that will power this, the chips that render 3D. So all of this metaverse activity is extremely good for NVIDIA and for their shareholders. But the CEO of NVIDIA is a visionary fellow. I've had the privilege of talking to him about his vision. It's a compelling vision. And NVIDIA has a whole project called Omniverse, and that is enterprise-grade metaverse. So we can take a minute and talk a bit about that. And then the last company that I would mention, but by far not the least, probably the most significant company, but one that's flying under the radar a little bit for most people, is a company called Unity. And you may have heard of them. Unity makes tools and engines to build great games. And about 3/4 of games today that are published on mobile are built with the Unity engine. Now, for those who aren't in the game industry, building a 3D engine is a big undertaking. And in the old days, pre-Unity, each company had to build that themselves. So that meant tons of tremendously talented valuable developer time was devoted to building out 3D engines that have already been built by other companies. So what Unity does is they make that a licensable thing that greatly accelerates the time to market. It also frees those great engineers and developers to work on other parts of the game and make better games. So no surprise, Unity powers a lot of games. So you might think of them as the company that's selling the picks and the shovels to the miners who are heading out to the gold mines to dig their way into the metaverse, if you will. So that's an overview of the different kinds of companies. There are game companies, there are American game companies, Chinese game companies, tools and infrastructure companies like NVIDIA and Unity. And then, of course, Facebook, who's been getting all the headlines. And then the companies that are diametrically opposed, the decentralized companies.
So that's a really fascinating overview to demonstrate that, you know, while we may have heard of it mostly from the context of Mark Zuckerberg's vision, that really there is an awful lot going on here. And there are an awful lot of pointers to say that the time might actually be now between the fact that the game companies are all in, that you've outlined some of the companies that are, you know, building the building blocks, so to speak. Bitcoin is important because it's a virtual money system. And you know, the time, if we weren't sure that the time was now, we've all spent the last 2 years on Zoom or otherwise, you know, in sensory deprived efforts at getting work done. So I can see how it all sort of comes together in an interesting point in time right now. But I think that a piece that you haven't mentioned that is tying it all together too, and what makes this different than a really good distributed game, is the fact that everything is becoming dematerialized. Do you want to tell us a little bit about dematerialization?
My favorite topic. Yes, dematerialization is a topic I love to talk about. It's something I've been writing about for a long time, and I've been studying for about 20 years. About 5 years ago, I published a book called Vaporized, which is all about the dematerialized economy. And at that time, it was principally focused on mobile phones. And my observation is that the mobile phone was absorbing the functionality of a lot of stuff in the real world. The example I would give is, in 2006, before the modern smartphone, if you got on an airplane and you were flying cross country and you got up to walk around on the airplane, you would notice that people had things like, you know, portable game players, electric book readers, MP3 players and so forth, DVD players. No one has that stuff. Literally, nobody carries that stuff around anymore. That habit has simply been lost forever because all that feature functionality has been absorbed into your phone or into a tablet. And so these handheld devices have gotten so much more capable and so much more intelligent that they've started to absorb the feature functionality of consumer electronics devices. And in the process, they destroyed those consumer electronics companies. So giant companies that used to be formidable in consumer electronics, companies like Sharp and Panasonic and even Sony, where I used to work, those companies are a shell of their former selves, at least in terms of consumer electronics. They've all pivoted into other industries and mostly into B2B and selling components now. But that the mobile phone has simply driven them out of the market. And I'll tell you something that's amazing. I am an avid photographer, and when I travel, I always carry a camera, even though I constantly wonder whether it's worth the wait to carry that camera anymore. And I just got back from a trip to Mexico, and I had the new iPhone, and I compared the photos from the iPhone and the digital camera. I've come to the conclusion that I can't really see a huge difference anymore, and the new cameras on the phones are so good, I probably don't need to carry that, you know, the actual physical camera and its battery and charger and all that stuff with me anymore. So this is what happens: is we start to forget that we ever had these habits. We drop habits. I would say that the mobile phone has reprogrammed consumer behavior around the world. This is sweeping, and in some respects, it's insidious because we don't really pay attention to it. But if you think of all the things we've learned how to do, how to like and share and swipe left and swipe right and scroll and so forth. We programmed the behavior of about 5 billion people in the span of less than a decade. That's really quite remarkable. Now, along the way, the companies that have been doing this process of dematerialization, they're not limited to, you know, dematerializing music and maps and games or the devices that play them. They've expanded it into many other fields. So during the pandemic, many of us got to experience remote learning. Vaporized learning, you know, learning on a computer or learning on a phone or a tablet. And I would say that that probably wasn't a great experience for most people. And that's because the universities are dead set against this. They do not want to dematerialize. They believe that their great value is the on-campus experience. I think they're tremendously wrong. I think they're gigantically incorrect about this. I believe that universities overdo for a complete rethink in how we deliver education. So one of the reasons that experience was bad is that the university simply refused to prepare for the eventuality that they'll have to teach by long distance. Some universities like Georgia Tech are focused on this, and they're developing expertise and training. And it will take time to develop that and to develop the curriculum, the right way to engage people, the right way to teach in the digital environment. But I know it's going to happen. The reason for that is quite simple. The maximum number of people who can attend college on campus is in the millions. The number of people that need to be educated is in the billions. So we simply don't have enough colleges and universities around the world to educate everyone who needs to be educated. And we do need to educate everyone. So I think that this is going to continue, this struggle between the on-campus experience and the virtualized experience. I think that's going to continue to occur. Another thing many people experienced during the pandemic was dematerialized healthcare. And in particular, some healthcare organizations made it possible for you to talk to a doctor on a phone. This is something I had envisioned years before when I was working in mobile apps and really wanted. I had developed mobile video and I thought, man, it would be really cool if you could skip the doctor's office and just talk to a doctor. Of course, that was a pipe dream back in those days. But because of the pandemic, suddenly they didn't want you to come to the clinic. And so suddenly all the healthcare companies got busy and they launched a mobile app that allowed you to talk directly to the doctor, schedule an appointment. And it turns out for most complaints, that's adequate. You don't actually need to go to a doctor's office, which is great because it's the time and inconvenience and the parking and the hassle. But also, the clinic is where the sick people are. You don't really want to go to a clinic. You know, so there is a positive experience with dematerialization. And there are many others. If you go to a hotel now, post-pandemic, what you'll notice is a lot of hotels no longer have. Yeah, they have paperless check-in, no key. You can use your phone as the key. And they no longer have a restaurant. They expect you to use Uber Eats or something like that. They don't have a concierge there to help you get tickets. You're going to use an app for that. They're not going to provide in-room entertainment. You have Netflix and Spotify for that. If you want to order up food, you can do that. If you need a car, you'll order a taxi service. And so as a result, the hotel is transformed into kind of like a featureless box.
To what extent do you think that this winds up being sort of a gateway into like the metaverse and dematerialization or meeting?
You know, Leslie, that's a really good point. I'm glad you bring it up, because what we have to notice is the companies that have been doing this dematerialization, they've been at it now for more than a decade. I date the time of this to the launch of the first iPhone in 2007, but that's arbitrary. We could say it starts with, you know, the first attempts to digitize Wall Street, which began in the 1970s, or we could say it starts with the World Wide Web in 1991 or 1993. You know, you can pick your own arbitrary starting point, but the effects became noticeable by 2010. That's what's important. This is the idea that a few companies that were driving this process of dematerialization were capturing all the value of the industries that they dematerialized, the industries that were vaporized, capturing all that value. And so in a really rapid sequence, companies like Apple have increased in value, and they have consolidated their grip on the economy around the world. You'll know that Apple, just 10 years after the iPhone was introduced, or actually less, in 2006, it's 2016, the 9 years after the iPhone was introduced, Apple's valuation, market valuation, was about $560 billion, which was high at that time. It was the highest ever for any company. And what's important about that is just 15 years before, Apple was only worth $5 billion. So they'd gone from a marginal, you know, also ran PC maker to the dominant company in the world in 15 years. And, you know, people attribute that to Steve Jobs' return and his great vision and so forth. They did execute brilliantly with the iPhone. Well, from 2016 to 2018, Apple added 50% to its market cap. So another $250 billion. And then by the end of 2018, broke the $1 trillion threshold. 2 years later, by 2020, Apple broke the $2 trillion threshold. And at the beginning of this year, 2022, Apple was valued at $3 trillion. And of course, now there's all kinds of uncertainty in the market. There's a war, there's a pandemic, there's inflation. So a lot of stock market prices have come down, particularly for tech. But Apple's still hovering in the $2.6, $2.7 trillion range. We've never had a company worth $1 trillion before. That's a new thing. We've certainly never had companies worth $2 or $3 trillion before. And now we have several, because Microsoft and Alphabet and Amazon are also trading in that range. And so these companies have managed to not just vaporize entire industries and seize the profits and, you know, kind of steal the value from those industries. They've also become too big to fail. And I think they might be too big to regulate. You know, right now in the United States, there's an attempt to apply regulatory scrutiny to some of the leading companies, Google or Alphabet, Facebook, and Amazon. And this is coming in a variety of ways. The DOJ is doing investigations. There are other investigations underway. And at the Federal Trade Commission, a new chairwoman, Lina Khan, is leading the charge against Amazon and against Facebook. And she's got a novel theory. About monopolies. In the past, for the past 50 years, U.S. law has been guided by a simple principle that about monopolies, which is that if there's a monopoly, you'll know it because they charge extraordinary prices. And so if you want to find damages from a monopoly, you'll see that they're charging what they call monopoly rents, extraordinarily high prices. And when you look at a company like Amazon, well, they don't charge high prices. They actually charge low prices, right? And they do like free shipping and so forth. So how is this a monopoly? And yet many people complain, book publishers complain, many, many people complain that Amazon's a monopoly. And by the way, I don't necessarily see it that way. I see Amazon fights fierce competition in every category, including cloud services, where they're the leader who invented that category. But nevertheless, Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission has developed a novel theory about monopoly power in a network. And she says in a network, it's different. You're not going to see the monopoly expressed in price. You're going to see the monopoly restructure the entire marketplace. And if you consider the way these big tech giants have built out apps and marketplaces, you know, where third parties can come in and sell their wares, they truly have created kind of their own economy. This is as true for the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store as it is for Facebook or as it is for Amazon Marketplace. And so this new theory of monopoly says that it's kind of like a structural theory of monopoly, that these companies can come in and have such great market power that they can restructure market. So those cases are in the middle of being prosecuted or litigated or investigated right now. And so we'll see. Watch this space. You'll see what happens. But I think the question for all of us and for your listeners in particular should be, what are the consequences of this level of consolidation that we've never seen before in history? And of course, these companies aren't stopping. They intend to grow. I mentioned healthcare a moment ago. Every major tech company has a gigantic healthcare initiative underway. You know, that's Microsoft, Apple, Alphabet famously has several. And these companies intend to get into the healthcare space. Why? Well, first of all, they have to keep growing. Their investors expect them to. Second, healthcare is bloated, inefficient, really expensive, and consumers hate it. It's a terrible consumer experience. So in other words, it's an industry that's ripe for disruption. And so it's a fat, juicy target. It's not the only one. Banking is another industry. People don't really like their banks very much. It's also inefficient, bloated, slow, conservative, cautious, over-cautious about regulation and so forth. And so every major tech company now has a payment system. They're all exploring new ways to do banking. We just saw news today that Facebook is exploring doing some kind of lending for small businesses and so forth. So tech companies are trying to bite off a piece of the finance industry. And you start to see them doing this across the industry. So the big question for us, I think, on this call is, do we want a company like that to dominate the metaverse? Like, do we want all of our transactions and all of our information and all of our healthcare and all of our transportation and all of our education, all of our work conversations and communications? Do we want all of that to flow through a single company? Isn't that kind of a scary scenario? And I know right now I'm making it sound as dystopian as possible because that makes for a good show, but also it's an important point and it's kind of the focus of this podcast. So I think it's an important topic.
It is interesting that a lot of the companies that you mentioned, other than the game providers, but even they are quite successful and profitable themselves. These are the companies that are vying for a space to mark their territory in the metaverse. And, you know, they say that history repeats itself, perhaps. And if you look back at how, when the early days of the internet, at least one of the good things was that there was a very specific decision made about governance at the very beginning. In other words, how will this system of names and numbers be governed so that there wouldn't be any one single stakeholder that had immeasurable control? Mm-hmm. And even throughout its life, there were decisions made, for example, to break up Network Solutions because it was, you know, monopolistic power. It was the only one who was selling the domain names. Here, do you see that happening as well? In other words, are there discussions about governance in such a way to at least provide some guardrails for the domination of any one of the metaverse by any one company?
It's an excellent question, Alexa, but you have to ask who is going to do that? Who's going to make that regulation or that law happen? And so we can think of three general jurisdictions where regulation is being contemplated. I'm sure it's being contemplated in many countries, but the principal jurisdictions that we would want to be focused on are China, the EU, and the United States, because these are very big economies and because they're also taking very different approaches. So in Europe, the European Union has attempted to regulate the internet space and they keep revising it and changing it. Famously, they have a privacy law that effectively forced every company on the internet to change their privacy activity. And that's interesting, right? Because that's extraterritorial, outside their jurisdiction. That's extraterritorial regulation, kind of a novel concept. And they had done a very clever thing. The European Union, when they were doing bilateral trade agreements with countries, say in Latin America and other parts of the global South, they embedded language in there that those countries would sign up for similar laws, similar privacy laws. And so what they did was they kind of created a coalition, if you will, of countries all over the world, basically outside the United States, to kind of gang up on the United States companies. And so they've been able to kind of force that privacy legislation and that right to be forgotten So that's one approach. I would not say that it's been tremendously effective. I think there's a lot of people are pantomiming compliance with that. So that's problem number one. The second thing is, I'm not sure how you might regulate this. So I don't think the EU has a great idea. I know they're very interested in regulating artificial intelligence, and I've been in a position to provide some advice informally to a couple of EU ministers who asked me about how to regulate artificial intelligence. And you have to really say, well, what goal are you trying to achieve? Like, what bad outcome are you trying to prevent and forestall? And we have to think very carefully that you don't inadvertently create worse outcomes someplace else, because that's always the law of unintended consequences that attends to just about every regulation that's introduced. So the EU is proceeding slowly at a stately pace to try to regulate where they can. But as you pointed out in the intro, they're far behind. They are trying to play catch up with tech companies. And the very fact that there's a competition with 1,000 or more companies trying to figure out what the metaverse is suggests to me that innovation is going to happen very quickly. There'll be brutal competition that forces innovation to occur at a very rapid clip, far faster than government regulators can catch up. Now, meanwhile, in China, they've taken a different approach. There, the president of China, who's effectively an autocrat with dictatorial power, simply came out and decreed that game companies can only allow people, children to play 3 hours at a time and so forth. So they just came out with a bunch of rules, and they have the power to enforce them. And any company that does not comply with the government and give access to their data to the government, well, that company simply doesn't have a license to operate in China. So that's a kind of heavy-handed approach, but that's another way to go. Now, the downside there is there's a real strong possibility that the Chinese internet giants that they so carefully cultivated and grew, that those companies now, they may get stifled. Their growth might be stalled out. I think it's a very likely possibility. And already companies like Tencent are pivoting as fast as they can to growth outside of China, where they're less regulated. And so that's already happened in the past year as a consequence of those regulations. And then you have the United States, where historically we've taken a hands-off approach, right? The United States famously has had a laissez-faire approach, even back to the Clinton administration, when the World Wide Web was first introduced to consumers and first commercialized. The decision was made at that point, don't regulate prematurely, let the market unfold. And I think there was wisdom in that decision, that hands-off decision. Now, Alexa, to your point, the internet is originally conceived, the core architecture of the internet is decentralized by design. That's built in, and that hasn't changed. The internet infrastructure remains decentralized. Where we run into a problem with consolidation is at the application layer, on top of the hardware and on top of the network. And the problem there is simply this. Most people don't want to manage servers or manage their web presence or even manage their identity themselves. That's a lot of effort, and they're not really clear on what the benefit of that is. There might be benefit. I think there would be benefit for people to do this, but most people aren't going to do it. They're going to take the free email account. They're going to take the free subscription to the magazine. They're going to take the free home shipping, and they're going to give away their data to somebody else. And of course, it's not just one company that's collecting that data. It's an army of companies that we don't even know the names of. Like, literally, when you land on the web page for Yahoo or CNN, you're going to get cookies from more than 100 different companies. When the web page takes a long time to load on a thin network, that's not because of the content. That's not because of the pictures. That's because so many third-party cookies are being loaded into your machine. So much software is being loaded into your browser. And so they're tracking you across the web, building rich profiles. And what this leads to is another really important point when we think about the metaverse, because what I'm now describing is that there are companies out there that are building a profile of you. As one researcher put it to me, a researcher said to me, problem isn't that you have a web identity. The problem is that you've got hundreds of digital identities and you don't own any of them. And this is a really important point for your listeners to understand. You have hundreds of web identities or digital identities, but you don't own any of them. You might have an account at Facebook, a presence on Facebook, but if you decide to change your relationship with Facebook, you have literally one option and you can shut down your account. If you think about it for a month and then decide to come back and reactivate your account, well, guess what? Lo and behold, all your stuff is still there when you log back in. It's very difficult to totally permanently delete your stuff from Facebook. And again, that's by design. And this is true across the web. So rich profiles are being built of us. Now, when we come to the metaverse, often what we talk about it as an immersive world. That's the term I use to describe it, a 3D world that you can go into and be a part of. So it's like three-dimensional social networking and three-dimensional e-commerce. And I think those will be parts of it. But what's really important to remember is one of the through lines in the metaverse is going to be your identity, the personality that you build, the version of you that you construct, and all the relationships that that entity has, that that person you construct has. That's all the personal relationships and all the accomplishments and achievements, the stuff that you build, the stuff that you express, the way you talk about things, the information and content that you share. And so that you can imagine there's like a whole constellation of data around that identity. And the big question in my mind is, who owns that? Who owns your identity in the metaverse? You know, we can imagine certainly that it's going to be Facebook. If you're going to go to, if you're going to Meta Horizons world, you're going to be, your data will be owned by Facebook. Your profile is owned by Facebook. You cannot access that stuff without a Facebook account.
I mean, this sounds like something that's ripe for disruption though, that, you know, you have these very large companies who are monetizing data and your identity that you don't even know. Mm-hmm. You have multiple, you know, digital identities. You don't even know where they are, and they're monetizing it. And the whole premise is because this whole system is built on advertising, online advertising. The reason why that's so important is because we've got to do online advertising to be able to subsidize the various services. Because the assumption is the average user does not want to pay 50 cent here for, you know, subscription, mm-hmm. another dollar to read the local newspaper. Is that a fair assumption though? In other words, so many things have changed so rapidly over the years and, you know, industries have come to their knees over assumptions that we didn't even know to question. So is it still a fair assumption to say that going forward, you know, 20 years from now, we will still have an economy that is advertising driven, therefore these questions of privacy and identity and data collection are still very pertinent. And there will be fights still between companies and between companies and governments as to who owns what and what are the limitations?
Yeah, so it's a super big question. It's probably like the big question, right? It's not just about the metaverse, that's the future of the internet.
Yeah.
You know, one thing you may have noticed is in the past year or two during the pandemic, most publications have now introduced a paywall. Mm-hmm. So we're used to be able to access the New York Times for free or magazines for free. Now you have to subscribe. And oh, by the way, the subscription price is a lot more. You used to be able to subscribe to a magazine for $10 a year.
Yeah.
Now they're charging $60 a year. It's like, whoa, that's a really huge price. Like, how many of those can you afford? So you have to really think carefully. So the first thing that's happening is that people are becoming conditioned to paying, which is interesting and new. Yeah. Or I guess new again, but we got conditioned to free thanks to Yahoo in the 1990s. And it's pretty hard to get people to go from free to paid.
It's like a pendulum that swings right? You know, centralized, decentralized, free.
And the same thing's happening with OTT video. So with streaming video, people went from, you know, cable TV, which they hated, but they liked, you know, it's kind of like a love-hate relationship. The cable bill kept going up every single year and you felt like you were getting jacked because, you know, like it was the same programming. It just cost more each year. So yay, we can now unbundle and we can go OTT and we can subscribe to Netflix and it's cheap. And Netflix was $5, then it was $7, then it was $8. Now it's $15. It's going up to $20. Where will it stop? You know, eventually you go, wait, the cable bundle was actually a better deal back in the day. And I didn't have to deal with like logging into a different service when I want to watch a different show. And so, yeah, you're at a point now where people are starting to feel like saturated with the number of subscriptions that they can deal with. And so, you know, is there a happy medium or balance in the middle? It's a great question. One of the problems is that you don't know, you have information asymmetry as a consumer. You don't know what you're giving away. And the other party knows exactly the value of it. In other words, when you sign up for a Facebook account, you don't know how you're going to be monetized. You don't know if you're worth $80 a year. That's what some people purport that you're worth as a user in North America of Facebook, that they make $80 a year off of you. Well, gosh, at $80 a year, first of all, why don't they share the wealth? You know, like really, couldn't they share $20 of that with me? I would love a Facebook account where I got $20 if I posted good stuff, you know?
Yeah.
That question is facetious, but it's actually being pursued seriously by some companies. And so now we're going to come back to the Web3 companies and the decentralized companies. Because all the decentralized tech and most of the Web3 tech revolves around cryptocurrency, there's a financial mechanism at the heart of it. to reward behavior and to incentivize behavior. Now, this is really interesting. We haven't had this before. And that's because of for a bunch of reasons. Microtransactions have always been a difficult thing to do on the internet. There's just a certain minimum floor level cost to doing a transaction with a credit card. You can't get below that. You know, so even for instance, if you buy stuff on Apple, Apple's App Store or on iTunes, you'll notice that Apple only hits your credit card once. They kind of aggregate all the charges and they're taking the risk that you might split or cancel the card, and they'll take the risk on that because it's not that huge. But once a month they do, because that way they only have to deal with one transaction with the credit card company. And the same is true. So that has been true across the board. It's been the bane of those who've been trying to do microtransactions for a long time. But now with cryptocurrency, we can do microtransactions. And so you're starting to see a whole proliferation now of new business models in the Web3 space. And they include people earning currency. This is a new novel concept, right? You may have heard of wages for Facebook, and that's for people who are prolific curators or prolific posters who share good content that people, other people value and find informative. Well, they ought to get some payment for that. They should get some of the rewards because they're creating great value for Facebook. But that doesn't happen. Facebook never does that. So now there are decentralized social networks that are exploring that very notion that their best users, the most active users, the best curators, those who post the most interesting and most followed content, those people should get a percentage of the revenue because they're creating some of the value. That's a revolutionary concept, yeah. Right? You can imagine it more as like a content economy. And then secondly, with that, that actually aligns people nicely. When you have free accounts that are ads in an ad-supported system, you have too many bots and too much garbage. And so now our social networks, including Twitter, have been flooded with crap from bots and from, you know, people who are trying to persuade with disinformation and so forth. I don't see that changing in the metaverse. You know, you'll have bots in the metaverse. It'll be awful. People will be trying to sell you stuff in the metaverse. Like, how horrendous.
Picturing Agent Smith, you know?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And like,
kind
you know,
nefarious pester, looking.
You know? Or like, you know, that like, cute looking person that you might be interested in the metaverse turns out to be like actually, you know, something that was put there by a retailer or some kind of, you know, brand that you're not even interested in. And then it becomes this weird stalker character. Like, you can just imagine how awful that experience could be and probably will be. So this idea of a in-game economy has been around for a long time in the gaming world, for more than 20 years. It's a well-understood thing. And most big online games have full-time economists who balance the economy so that it's stable. Now, those companies are really well positioned to start to introduce new experiences beyond gaming. And in fact, they've already done so. Minecraft, Fortnite, and Roblox have all had concerts, and they have a very lively music program going on. And if you think about it, it's a little funny, right? You go, wait a minute, they're doing concerts inside of an online game? What is that? Well, it's pretty powerful. An artist like Lil Nas X, who I think is one of the most interesting artists in the world right now, can attract an audience of 30 million people. Like, that's a fantastic number. Half the size of a Super Bowl audience, right? It's like, wow, that's an incredible number for a 20-minute concert inside of Roblox or inside of Fortnite. And Travis Scott did a similar thing inside of Fortnite. And by the way, these concerts are great. And if you didn't see them, if you weren't there, then you can watch them on YouTube because they're clipped on YouTube and you can see. And what I think this is one of the most interesting spaces for innovation right now. Because any artist that wants to connect with a mass audience, where do they do that? You know, there's no really, MTV is a shadow of its former self. Radio doesn't matter to a new generation. You can't connect with people on Spotify. They pick whatever they want to listen to and the algorithm decides what you're going to get. So if you're an artist and you really want to connect with people, it turns out those people are in game worlds and they're spending 15, 20 hours a week in those worlds. So that's where they live. And that's the vernacular they speak. That's the vernacular of their pop culture. And so the smart artists are starting to adopt that and don a guise that relates to people in that world. They're going to become masters of these worlds. So you can start to see some of the creative aspects of the metaverse already arising in games like Fortnite and Roblox. Mm-hmm. This to me is extremely interesting and fun and cool. And now you can imagine by extension that you'll start to see, you know, the cast from a TV show or a small version of a movie, maybe a preview version of a Star Wars movie or something. You can imagine that those two will become features inside of game worlds. So the game companies are really well positioned to start to roll out a version of the metaverse. Now, one of the things you'll notice that we're talking about is there's never one company, right? There's no one metaverse. There's multiple companies, right? In every category, you can think of four or five and probably a dozen that you don't even know about. And so it's not a metaverse. It's not the metaverse. It's almost ludicrous to talk about that as a singular entity or a singular concept. No, more important, I think, for your audience is to understand that this will be a multiverse. There will be many, many companies competing. And I think ultimately consumers will create their own metaverses. And so you'll have millions of metaverses. And earlier, the point was raised about interoperability. And this is a gigantic issue. I rank it with identity as some of the key things to understand about the metaverse. Is the metaverse you're interested in joining, is it interoperable or not? In other words, does it connect with other metaverses? Can you teleport from one universe to another? Or is it a dead end? Do you have to go in there and you can't come out and they're trying to keep you there and they're going to use artificial intelligence to program in such a way that it's highly addictive?
I certainly don't want to buy, you know, another Oculus or multiple headsets. I have one. I have an Oculus. And I certainly don't want to buy multiple ones just to...
But what I'm hearing in all of this, though, is that the real driver here is the economic one, the one that's been, you know, in shape for years and decades. And it's all how do these companies get a larger piece of the pie and keep your piece of the pie while they're at it? And in essence, the immersive nature of what we've heard of the metaverse is basically the candy coating on the pill.
Yeah.
Would you like blue or would you like red?
Exactly. That's the dystopian view, right? That they're that they're going to make this incredibly attractive and incredibly addictive. And bear in mind, there's some evidence to support that view. So Leslie, you're not wrong. And you're not just being, you know, skeptical or critical. I think it's good to think critically about these things. The Financial Times in February did an analysis of a number of patents that were written by Facebook that were submitted by Facebook to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And many of them were granted, and they surveyed hundreds. According to this report in the Financial Times, the patents are very strange. They all do pertain to either Oculus headsets or to virtual worlds in some way. So you can sort of get the sense that Facebook's trying to tighten up their IP portfolio around the headset and the virtual world. Now, there's no guarantee that Facebook's going to implement this because lots of companies file for lots of patents that they never actually use. But what's contained in the patents is alarming and exciting and weird. So like some of the ideas that are in the patents are things like this. They have a skin replicator that can detect your skin and replicate it in its tone. They have a way to track your pupils as they dilate. They have a way to check your hair follicles. They can check your body's involuntary reactions, your body posture and gestures and so forth. And you wonder, why does That's a so social creepy. Networking company need that? What are they going to do with it? And so in the Financial Times article, they talked to a couple of researchers who speculated that what Facebook's doing is building a high fidelity digital twin of each person in the metaverse. And this word digital twin, this phrase is important. So let's come back to that in a second. But this researcher speculated that what they're trying to do is create a digital version of you that they'll basically put to work and they'll start to test ad campaigns on to see where does it have an involuntary reaction? Where does it react or respond to something? And when they've perfected those ad offers, those are the ones that they're going to show to you. So in other words, they'll develop irresistible advertising in this world that is designed to bypass your filters, maybe hit you on a subliminal level. And by the way, think about the subliminal advertising when you're in a 3D world, you're moving through the world, all the signage, all the stuff in the background that you're passing, the signs on buses and cars and so forth. In a virtual world, all of that is going to be ad inventory for Facebook, but it'll be personalized to you. And they'll have this kind of digital version of you, call it a digital slave, if you will, a virtual version of you that they put in harness, testing constantly until they perfect the mix that will bypass your critical thinking filters and affect you at a subliminal level. That's the fear story, right? That's the scary story about Facebook Horizon. Again, I don't know that they're doing this. This is speculation from a researcher quoted in the Financial Times. But nevertheless, they did file the patents, and in many cases, they were granted these patents. And so you have to consider that these companies, they're not doing this for free, right? They're doing this to gain. And at the moment, a moment ago, I should say, I started my remarks with this concept that these companies have grown in value. Apple notably doubled in size during the past 10 years. It's extraordinary. We've never seen a rise like that. It's almost exponential growth in terms of their market capitalization. The one company, the U.S. tech companies that didn't grow at that rate is Facebook. And Facebook was on track to grow rapidly, and they were doing quite well. Until around 2018, they started to hit a wall, and their share price has stalled and plummeted since that time. And that's largely because of inept management and some horrendous decisions that were made that led to great blunders, ethical blunders, privacy blunders, deliberate, in some cases, apparently deliberate violation of privacy law. And so as a result, Facebook has lost the trust of government. It's lost the trust of users. It's under scrutiny, and Wall Street has abandoned it. And when Facebook's CEO, Zuckerberg, changed the name of the company to Meta, it didn't look like a brilliant branding move, say the way, you know, Google rebranded itself Alphabet and put all those moonshots into a different category so that people could track Google's progress more accurately. Instead, what it looked like very much was when Philip Morris changed the name of the company to Altria, and you know, basically tried to get away from their legacy of being a horrible tobacco company. Facebook, the brand is tarnished beyond belief, and they're basically ready to jettison that brand. And that was what the pivot to Meta was all about. So here's a company that quite deliberately seems to be designing ways, you know, you might say enslave people in an ad-driven world. That's a very dark view of it. And again, I got that from the Financial Times. I don't know that. I don't have firsthand information about that. But given the interests of this platform, I think it's interesting for you folks to track this story.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it leaves me wondering, as we come to a close now, what's the one thing, one takeaway you would want our listeners to have from all of this?
Oh, well, the one thing to take away is the metaverse is inevitable. I believe it's coming. I don't think it's like a theory. I think it's in practice. It's happening now. I think most of the current attempts are going to fail for a variety of reasons. They're too controlled. They're too centralized. They're too much like one person's vision. There's not enough room for creativity. I don't think people want to make replicas of themselves. I think people want to experiment with different, you know, different personality types and so forth. But you know, all these companies will pivot until they find a combination of factors that works. What you need to recognize now is while the metaverse might sound a little fanciful or a little bit like science fiction, now most industry analysts are starting to say it's inevitable. It's not just a big opportunity. And just a couple of days ago, JP Morgan Chase came out and said it's a $1 trillion opportunity. But months before that, the folks at Bernstein, the analysts at Bernstein came forth and said that it's a $7 or $8 trillion industry. And so there's great potential there. Here's the way to think about the future of the web. It's simply going to get richer and more interactive and more immersive. And so the metaverse is the internet. And today we carry it around in our pockets or in our purses. Pretty soon we're going to wear it. It'll be in our eyeglasses and our contact lenses. Pretty soon it'll be embedded in the environment around us. Shortly after that, it'll be a heads-up display in an automobile, or it'll be something that surrounds you when you're flying in an airplane. I can imagine very clearly that the web is going to start to mingle with the world around us in the form of augmented reality or extended reality. I think people are going to find services that they like, but this all comes at a cost, and there's always a downside to all these new technologies. So while I see that as inevitable, and I think it'll be full of some fun opportunities for people and some good business opportunities, I'm also aware that that means we're going to start to program our own reality. We're going to start to self-select our own reality. In a way, it's like choose your own reality. And you can imagine in a world where everybody has augmented reality goggles, one person will be in the Hello Kitty universe, another person will be in the Marvel universe, and another person is going to be in the death metal universe. You can just imagine the kind of weird misunderstandings people are going to have when they're coming at each other from these different universes. So on that weird note, I guess that's about all we can cover today. This has sure been fun talking to you about these things.
Yeah, it's been a riot. Thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Robert. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.